to talk mainly about the overall trends, you have to gloss over the exceptions. Mm-hmm. And it's in the exceptions that we find the tools that we're going to want to resist the trends.
Right.
Hello again.
Hello.
Welcome back to The Book on Fire. We are talking about the dawn of everything. This is episode 5 of the season. We're talking about chapter 4, mm-hmm. though, because mm-hmm. we snuck in a little extra episode in there that wasn't directly about the book. We're talking about chapter 4, which is called Free People, The Origin of Cultures, and the Advent of Private Property. Big topics, big topics. Before we get into that, though, I want to acknowledge that if our calculations have panned out correctly, then this episode will probably have come out a little later than the release schedule that we have set up for ourselves for this season already. We've been getting the episodes out every 2 weeks on a Wednesday, but this one's going to be late and might not be the only one that's a little late. This is, we're recording this right now. This is April 1st. And this is the time of year when we are just getting even more busy, super mm-hmm. busy, have a lot to do. We've been planting trees. We've been spreading manure in the garden. We've been doing lots of things like that. We have classes getting ready to come out to our land. We need to get ready for that. There's lots of things, actually. School season is underway.
Yeah, we're really busy. We want to keep up this podcast. We talked about maybe taking a break and then coming back to it, but we think we would rather just put out the episodes mm-hmm. on a more relaxed schedule and still keep up the momentum we do have with the book.
Yeah, we decided to just allow ourselves more time mm-hmm. Between episodes and, you know, but still commit to
yeah.
putting them out as we can. So maybe, you know, get used to that. And when the new episode comes out, it'll surprise you when it comes.
It might surprise us.
We are getting a lot out of reading this book.
Yeah.
And it's really like, I think, yeah, this engagement that we've been having with it for Janet and I both, this is our second time reading the book. And it's just, we're getting in a lot deeper, asking a lot more questions. The conversations that we've been having with y'all, with those of you who have come onto the Discord, have been really enlightening, getting at different aspects of what the book is trying to do and branching off, you know, to things outside of the book. And I think we both feel really good about where this is headed. And I think that by the time we get to the end of the book, we'll have like potentially advanced from what the Davids are trying to do mm-hmm. here. Or maybe decoded what they're trying to do a little bit more thoroughly and made some progress with holding it alongside our own thoughts and the other discussions about this material that's happening in other realms or just among y'all who are listening. And I think that we'll come out of this, you know, collectively smarter and equipped with like some really great new concepts, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say
even
that.
Even just then the book provides on its own.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I think that with the help of some very good readers who are in discussion with and with just the ways that we're generating ideas by talking to each other and to you guys, I have the hope. I'm starting to have hope that we're going to actually get through this and come out with some tools.
Yeah.
And tools for actually applying the important contributions that are in here while holding space also for some of the limitations yeah. of what is here.
Yeah. And maybe being able to collectively move beyond the limitations mm-hmm. of what's in here too.
Yeah.
So if you like what we're doing with this book and the conversations that we're having, stick with us. Stick with us. There's 12 chapters in the book and we're hoping, you know, to do the whole thing. And participate if you want to participate in the conversations that we're having on the Discord server and tell your friends about mm-hmm. the podcast too. You know, this is obviously like a labor of love for us to do this podcast. And we know that there's a lot of you out there listening. We're really grateful for that. And, you know, one of the the main rewards that we get from doing this, you know, besides the conversations themselves, is seeing that people are finding us, you know, and that they're subscribing and that they are listening. Yeah. So share the podcast with your friends.
Yes, that would be wonderful. We don't really, this is not our job.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, we love our job. Those jobs that we get paid for and those that we do not get paid for, teaching and client work, but also tending this land that we live on. But all that being said, our time is pretty precious. And so
it's not our goal to quit our jobs to do the podcast.
No,
full-time.
It's really not. So it's mostly just the reward of like having more people engage in this conversation and knowing that the labor in the end, it is a lot of labor to put out, especially Dave is our main editor. And wow, he puts in a lot of hours on this to make us sound smarter than we are.
Yeah, it's more than you'd think, maybe.
But
anyway.
Anyway, yes, please tell your friends and do all the things. But we're so grateful for how many people are listening. It's always exciting to see.
It's really gratifying.
The number of downloads every time an episode comes out.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what about chapter four?
What about chapter four?
What about chapter four? You know, one of the interesting and maybe kind of surprising things that this book is doing, we're far enough into the book that I think we can make some generalizations, or we can see the shape that it's taking. And one of the things that this book is doing is that it's asking us to take another look at some cultural features that, you know, say, especially an anarchist might believe clash, or that we've been taught clash with freedom, like that don't coexist well with freedom.
Maybe even, yeah, prohibitive, possibly to freedom.
Prohibitive, maybe to freedom.
Yeah.
Especially in like an anarchist sense. They want us to take another look and to reconsider these things, right? And in chapter three, that thing that they wanted us to reconsider was hierarchy. They proposed in chapter three that maybe we can actually have a little hierarchy with our freedom.
At least part of the time.
Without ruining our freedom. Provided that that hierarchy is, yeah, like part-time, that it only exists for part of the year, that we can like walk away from it, or that that hierarchy is like kind of a play hierarchy. The word that they always use is play, you know, like maybe it's only for ceremonial purposes. So that was chapter three. But in chapter four, the thing that they want us to reconsider is property, material surplus, and wealth, and including unequal wealth, wealth inequality. You know, the Davids, like they are explicitly proposing here that maybe we can have a little wealth inequality with our freedom without impinging on our freedom. You know, so interestingly, this is like an interesting project, right? Like they're trying to actually carve out space for like hierarchy and wealth inequality and stuff in our concept of freedom. And this is pretty radical for a anarchist type project. You know, stuff that they're going to propose later in the book, that maybe there's room for agriculture or there's room for urbanization, to me sound like less radical prospects actually.
And I just want to clarify too that by radical, you're actually like, even you're not beyond saying like this is a new and extreme way of looking at things. It's actually radical in that to the root, like many of our conceptions of the root of abuse of power or root of the state have to do with these concepts. And so they're sort of trying to recreate or reframe our foundational concepts.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, like radical as in, you know, what is at the root of oppression? And like, what is at the root of, I was going to say at the root of hierarchy. But yeah.
Systems of domination.
What is at the root of domination?
Yeah.
Is it hierarchy? And they're like, no, no, because, you know, hierarchy, they propose in chapter three that maybe hierarchy's kind of always been around. You know, it just hasn't always been in these like really oppressive forms.
Or was not always so entrenched.
Not always so entrenched.
Yeah.
Not always so real. So imposing. Yeah, one of the moves that they actually make repeatedly in the book, and we're starting to become aware of this now, and we'll come back to this kind of at the end of the chapter, but is to propose that, you know, something like hierarchy or something like private property that perhaps have been theorized to sort of like arrive on the scene mm-hmm. at a particular, you know, historical moment, like with the advent of agriculture or something like that. They're proposing that maybe these things have like always been with us, mm-hmm. that they go all the way back, that we've never been without hierarchy. It's just that the older forms of hierarchy are these sort of embryonic mm-hmm. forms. They only existed in special circumstances, maybe. They didn't have a whole lot of power to really command, you know. And then the story is not about how hierarchy ever emerged, but it's about how it achieved these more oppressive forms, mm-hmm. you know. And as we'll see in chapter 4, they kind of do a similar thing with property, mm-hmm. with private property.
They start out this chapter talking a little bit about what we do know about the various cultures of the Upper Paleolithic before they transition into talking about peoples of the Neolithic, which will be more of the emphasis of this chapter, although they are also going to talk about some contemporary ethnographies as well mm-hmm. and how those inform what we might know about the Neolithic.
Right.
Peoples.
And they also focus on what is called the Mesolithic.
Oh, right.
Who are like, you know, kind of transitional people or transitional cultures.
They probably wouldn't like that word.
They don't love that, but they use the term Mesolithic to talk about how early in the Holocene, before agriculture became like widespread, so mm-hmm. that would be the Neolithic, with the Neolithic revolution, you do see more patterns of settlement, people being less nomadic on average, and more centered around resources like hazelnuts and acorns, or more diversity of subsistence.
Right.
Including some settlement.
Including some
and
settlement.
And intensification. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and one thing that they follow or are sort of tracking as they discuss peoples from the Upper Paleolithic to the Mesolithic to the Neolithic is that there seems to be a trend of people's worlds growing smaller, which might be somewhat counterintuitive to us.
Yeah. Yeah. They talk about the material evidence in the Paleolithic where they say from the Swiss Alps to Outer Mongolia, you can find a lot of the same material culture from the Paleolithic. So the same kind of figurines that are carved, the same kind of musical instruments, you know, like I'm sure that they don't mean identical, but there's enough similarities to think that culturally, at least, you could maybe think of it as like one big continent spanning like kind of cultural sphere in a certain way. And they admit that there's no knowledge of like the languages people spoke and, you know, things like that.
Yeah. And then from that period where people did seem to be moving around quite a bit, through the Mesolithic and into the Neolithic, there started to be more settlements and people staying in one place. Mm-hmm. And they acknowledge that this sometimes led to emergence of more stratified forms of society, sometimes, not always, as we're going to get to later in the book. But they're discussing this sort of like contraction a little bit of social life for people,
right?
That they got around less. And also, which I think this comes later in the book as well, there starts to be more of a diversification of culture,
Yeah, like they talk about one thing that they highlight is cuisine.
Oh, yeah.
Right, you know, because there was different types of like food resources that were being utilized by people in different places And so like cooking techniques were being invented, and you start to see like regional cuisines and things like that, that start to emerge, you know, and so like what they're tracking is kind of this counterintuitive thing where we maybe think that like our modern era is this like globe spanning,
very cosmopolitan,
international cosmopolitan culture. And they're saying like, well, maybe that's kind of true now for some people, you know, like the jet set class or something, but it was actually pretty normal for the Paleolithic for culture to be shared over a wide area and for people to actually move around over wide areas, like you were saying, Janet. But that we see this thing that might be a little bit surprising or counterintuitive to track, which is people's worlds actually getting smaller as, you know, material culture like advanced or something, and there were like more technologies and play and whatever, like that, that people were likely to have less knowledge of the folks who lived 500 miles away or maybe even 100 miles away,
right,
you know, than had been true before. And they don't exactly take the obvious step of maybe tying that to the fact that people were adopting more settled life ways,
right,
you know, which seems like that would be the obvious explanation for that, is that, yeah, intensification, people being like tied to a land base more tightly than in the Paleolithic. But they do suggest that this kind of like world's getting smaller, people being more tied to a small geographic area would make it harder for people to experience the fluidity of politics that they highlight in chapter three with seasonal dispersal and just walking away, you know, from hierarchy and all of these things, with a world that's getting smaller, that there's less room to just like have this kind of loose political formations that are really easily transformed.
Yeah, I guess unless your area that you're tied to has something like a migration of the buffalo or something, that's there's another factor that would lead to that seasonal shift in societal organization.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all very place specific.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. One thing that is nice to think about is this like cosmopolitan Paleolithic.
Yeah.
The book at various points keeps coming back to this point that until recently, long distance travel was just assumed to be like a normal part of life for people when they were experiencing more freedom. You know, that like even if you lived in an agricultural town in Turtle Island or something, then it would be assumed to be like a normal part of your life that you could spend some of it traveling over long distances, you know, and meeting strange people who lived far away and seeing new lands. You know,
and it wouldn't just be those who are like special kinds of spiritual people who go on a pilgrimage. It might just be part of life.
Not necessarily. Part of the thing that they're trying to get us to see is like, yeah, our world has trains and airplanes and boats that go across the sea, all this stuff. And there's so much transportation, but actually travel was a much more widely distributed like right. You know, basically, you know, people travel a lot now, but it's really like a upper echelon of the affluent in the world that travel much for pleasure.
Unless you're more a part of a, like a dropout subculture that is like riding trains or hitchhiking, which is seems
that's
to
kind
be,
of like trying to reclaim this thing.
You know? That's true.
So all of that about people's worlds getting smaller is really interesting to think about. It's also just the first like two pages of the chapter. And it's not even really strongly connected to what comes after. Right after that part is the beginning of the polemic that is like the setup for archaeological exhibits that are going to come later, anthropological exhibits. And this is where they start getting into talking about property and wealth. They begin by returning to the theme of egalitarianism, which they spend a lot of the first half of the book attacking, and they return for another attack by asking, like, what precisely is equalized in egalitarian societies? They go through, like, what's become, like, a characteristically kind of funny, for me, couple of paragraphs where they try and show that equality is not a good standard because, like, there's so many different things that could be equalized, you know, and they come up with some hilarious examples. It's almost like they're like, if you lived in a culture that said that every year everybody on their birthday got a single donut, could you call that an equal culture? You know, because everybody just gets the same donut every year on
their
birthday.
If that's what that culture values,
if that's what that culture values, then this would be an egalitarian culture. And that's not a literal example from the book, but it's the kind of thing that they're doing in these couple paragraphs. But anyway, moving beyond that, where they end up with all of this is by saying, like, you know, because different cultures have different values, social scientists end up just having to kind of arbitrarily pick a feature that is going to be the standard for equality in an egalitarian society. And they say, well, ever since the Enlightenment times and the days of like Rousseau and Adam Smith and Turgot, this has been wealth and property.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So equality has been about equality of wealth and property. And they kind of argue that, you know, basically because these guys decided to frame things in this way, this is even why we have a category like hunter-gatherer. Mm-hmm. Because it's downstream of Rousseau, mm-hmm. you know, because this is how we get mired in categorizing people based on their means of subsistence, mm-hmm. because it's about how they acquire, like, the resources mm-hmm. that they need to survive.
Right.
Right. It's an economic categorization of people. What mm-hmm. is the economy of these people? Well, they hunt and they gather, mm-hmm. you know, right? And the Davids are a little bit derogatory mm-hmm. about this like obsession with paying so much attention to how people acquire food.
Right.
It's kind of like, they're like this obsession with how people get food. And that's kind of funny, like as if that's not really important. Mm-hmm. But anyway, kind of where they're going with this mm-hmm. is they're talking about the discourse on property and wealth that was initiated at the time of Rousseau, and about how this is basically how the story of inequality and domination gets told, mm-hmm. is that as soon as people are capable of amassing a surplus, mm-hmm. as soon as you have more than you need to survive, mm. you know, then there's going to be people who emerge to lord over the surplus mm-hmm. and control the surplus. And that's how they get power over other people.
Right.
And that's how we become unfree. And that's how society becomes unequal, mm-hmm. you know, and that's all kind of part of the same thing. Mm-hmm. And in the conventional narrative, that moment is agriculture.
Right.
That's kind of like the sketched out, mm-hmm. not very detailed version of history is like before agriculture, it was hunter-gatherers. They were mainly egalitarian. They didn't have a surplus. And then you have agriculture. Agriculture all of a sudden creates the possibility for a surplus, for producing more food than you can use, or at least more food than you can eat, mm-hmm. like right away. And so you end up storing food. And then people have to like administer the surplus. And that's how some people get power over other people.
Right. I want to add one little thing here, which is a corrective, just yeah. in case. It's not a big deal corrective.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on how you think about things. But they say that humans are the only species that create or produce surplus.
They do say that.
That is not true. I'm sure there are a fair number of other animals that store food or make surplus, but I was mm-hmm. specifically thinking about squirrels.
Yeah.
And how squirrels actually stash acorns all over the forest, all over the campus, the suburb, wherever the squirrels are living.
The campus.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about where I see lots of squirrels.
Yeah.
And squirrels are very tied to the distribution of nut-bearing trees, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And so because they don't remember where they all are, mm-hmm. and they don't need as much as they store. Both yeah. things are true.
Yeah.
And so they actually are disseminators of oak trees.
Yeah.
And probably other nut-bearing trees where they are. So this is just to say there are some ways of producing more than you need and actually contributing to the larger ecosystem.
Yeah. Squirrels help. Squirrels plant trees. That's true. I was just thinking about spiders and how I've seen spider webs where maybe there were a couple extra flies stuck in the web.
That's true.
Later.
Just yeah. in case.
You know, they're like storing them up.
That might be true. Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, the point could be made that since spiders, and I don't know about squirrels, but are not social animals, mm-hmm. that there's not this problem of
right.
administering the surplus collectively or something. But that's kind of a separate point. They do say that humans are like the animal that makes a surplus.
Right.
As if it was a unique thing.
Yeah.
And you have, yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, it's funny because during this whole part, which is they're going to return to around the surplus, I've been thinking about Bataille's books on the accursed share, because he is part of the lineage who thinks that surplus is what leads to domination, systems of domination and hierarchy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that it's how we administer.
Yeah, he was very interested in the surplus.
How
yeah.
we administer the surplus is how things can go very wrong and often mm-hmm. do go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think about those squirrels and all the extra acorns and think of that as the accursed share, then it makes me laugh.
The accursed extra share of acorns.
Yeah.
I can see the meme.
Yeah.
already. I can
my
just
my very niche meme that
Janet's gonna
three,
make a
three people could get
share squirrel meme for this episode. Watch for it. Oof. Yeah. So here they like briefly introduce, I mean, as if anybody needs to be introduced really to this conventional narrative that it was agriculture and the surplus entailed with agriculture mm-hmm. that enabled people to get power over other people. Mm-hmm. And specifically, it's been claimed that agriculture is the seed of the state. Mm-hmm. You know, the granary is the seed of the state. I don't remember who that's a quote from.
And in fact, it is at least true that there has not been a state formation without grain cultivation. Can we say that?
Yeah, I think that's true. They're going to devote a whole chapter or mm-hmm. two later in the book specifically to like the problem of agriculture. Mm-hmm. But we know, maybe listener, you also know that it is a more complicated story than that. The agriculture narrative might do for like a 3-sentence summary mm-hmm. of human history, but if you look very closely at all, it gets more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. But there is a connection, mm-hmm. and the development of agriculture is really important, maybe not as the seat of hierarchy, but for the actual form that we call the state, mm-hmm. you know. But we'll come back to that. The Davids do include a paragraph here where they question the inevitability mm-hmm. of agriculture causing the formation of the state, mm-hmm. you know, and the analogy that they draw is calculus and the atom bomb, mm-hmm. you know, because basically what they're saying is, yeah, agriculture happened, and then after that, the state happened, and the states that happened did depend on agriculture for their economic base, mm-hmm. you know, just like inventing the atom bomb depended on the knowledge of calculus. Mm-hmm. But could you really say that the invention of calculus caused the atom bomb? Mm-hmm. Which is an interesting point, but it strikes me that strict causality mm-hmm. is maybe too high a bar to set mm-hmm. for a significant correlation.
Right.
You know, yeah, like maybe it didn't cause the state, but I don't think it justifies ignoring the correlation mm-hmm. between grain agriculture and states
right.
just to show that it's not a strictly causal relationship.
Right. One way to say it might be to say that, yes, it is true that maybe you don't automatically get a state uh-huh. with agriculture.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you cannot have a state without agriculture.
Right. So that would be one thing to say is that, is it the necessary precondition?
Right.
You know, and that's not the same as a cause.
No.
That's totally true.
Right.
You know, a precondition, yeah, like calculus is a precondition for the atom bomb.
Right.
Let's just say that's true. Does that mean it makes the atom bomb inevitable? No, it doesn't. But having something as a precondition is something mm-hmm. worth pointing out. Also, and this is not the only place in the book where the Davids like really argue against the purported inevitability mm-hmm. of a certain chain of events. And it means a lot to them mm-hmm. to show that a chain of events was not inevitable.
Right.
And part of what I wonder, though, and this is like just a question I'm going to hold open, mm-hmm. Or maybe you have some thoughts on this, Janet, but if you were going to accept their arguments against inevitability mm-hmm. and you replaced inevitable with just likely, mm-hmm. then where does that leave you? If you say the invention of grain agriculture, it doesn't make the state inevitable, it just merely makes the state likely.
Right.
Then, like, what have you done there? Because they spend a lot of energy moving mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. inevitable to likely.
Right.
I mean, I think that, like, part of what this is about is, like, in the gap between inevitable and likely are all the other possible worlds.
Absolutely, right.
And those are the possible worlds that they are most interested in talking about.
Yeah, like the 1,000 years between, say, the development of agriculture in a place, in a historic site,
yeah,
and the actual emergence of the state. Mm-hmm. That's a long time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and so what was going on during that time period? And I think that what you're right about is that they really want possibility. What yeah. they want is possibility and potential for difference.
Yeah.
They want flexibility.
Yeah.
And if we keep or hold on to too rigid of a framing yeah. of any of these things, like different patterns being inevitable, mm-hmm. different modes of mm-hmm. subsistence or existence being the only way to be,
yeah.
then we don't have a very wide range of possibility. And we may have very little possibility, actually, of a future with less hierarchy.
Well, sure. Yeah.
If mm-hmm. we hold on to those
right.
frameworks.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think from like a more academic perspective,
right.
you could accuse Graeber and Wengrow of maybe overcorrecting.
Yes, absolutely.
Where they don't just want to show that it's not inevitable. They also don't want to talk about the overall trends of history
mm-hmm.
at
yeah,
all.
Right.
Yeah, like to focus on the trends maybe threatens our imaginative capacity.
Absolutely, right.
Because to talk mainly about the overall trends, you have to gloss over the cracks
mm-hmm.
and the exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the exceptions that we find the tools that we're going to want to resist the trends.
Right. You know, but if we are going to think about it in another way, like reframe this, we could say that if we don't know what the trends are, it right. will be hard to avoid them.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think there's like a both and
mm-hmm.
thing that we could do here.
If you're growing grains, you can feed a lot of people and you can store food and you can make it through hard times.
Right.
However, there is a great danger that comes with growing grains and storing up large amounts of them. Maybe we could say that.
Right. It creates ripe conditions
mm-hmm.
for appropriation of surplus,
right.
taxation, standing armies, all these things. And in fact, we see that this has happened time and time again.
Mm-hmm.
And so with growing grains, we need to
be ready,
have structures that ward off those very possibilities,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they would have to be robust.
Robust, for sure.
You know, they
yes.
would have to be robust. Yeah. And maybe even you would decide, if you were designing a society, not to subsist on grains
mm-hmm.
for this very reason.
Right.
You know, and subsist on yucca and yams instead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which are another calorie source that are, that, you know, but we'll get into that with chapter 6, or maybe it's chapter 7.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, the academics, they read this book and they're like, no one's saying it was inevitable.
Right.
Like, what are you guys talking about?
I mean, again, I think it's the populist
yeah.
version that they're talking to.
Right. But they intend to speak to this, like, popular conception
mm-hmm.
that leaves out all the detail
mm-hmm.
and just talks about the broad strokes and how that can kill the imagination.
Right. And they don't care what they got to burn down for that to happen.
Yeah. And they don't...
All right, so
yeah.
Sorry,
yeah, I keep coming around to this term, the sloppy demolition.
Mm.
The sloppy demolition that is happening in the first few chapters of this book,
right.
you know, that is like, has made a ton of people mad, you know, because it really is like just excessive and kind of wrong in some places, but it is in the service
yeah.
of this
goal,
trying to build the revolutionary imagination,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're doing it in a peculiar way.
Right.
Yeah.
And it appeals a lot to people who actually don't know the specifics and don't see what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you just do a quick read without thinking too hard and you do know some of the specifics, that could also be appealing.
Yeah.
You know? But unfortunately, I do wish that they had attempted to feed the radical imagination of people within their fields as well.
I was thinking the other morning, I was actually laying in bed, unable to sleep, and I was thinking about the book. And I was thinking about how one way that they could have started this book
mm-hmm.
is to say, we think that it's common for both anthropologists and the general public to overstate the determining power of material conditions
mm-hmm.
in human political history.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that focusing on material conditions can lead to a framework that's too deterministic.
Mm-hmm. And too constrictive.
And too constrictive.
Mm-hmm.
And so since everybody acknowledges that material conditions aren't 100% deterministic, that we are going to write a book that assumes that material conditions account for no more than, say, 50% of the determining factors
mm-hmm.
of the outcomes of history. And we're going to spend our book talking about the other 50% of factors.
Yeah.
And then they could have gone on and written their theories about private property starting in ritual spaces and, you know, all this stuff that they put forward in the book, and could have just started the book off like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what they did instead was just like came out with their guns blazing and just taking shots at all this stuff. And I bet it was a lot more fun for them to do it that way.
It was fun, but it makes our job a lot harder.
It makes it harder.
It makes our job a lot harder.
It makes it harder to get the message because there is a lot of noise.
But there is a message, and we're excavating it from the sloppy demolition.
Yeah.
Or at least trying to.
It's true. We're sifting through the rubble of the sloppy demolition to piece together the positive narrative.
Yeah.
All right. Woo! So moving right along, what comes next, speaking of surplus, is they actually bring in James Woodburn, the famous hunter-gatherer anthropologist. I brought up James Woodburn in episode 3. He is the theorist of immediate return versus delayed return economies. And Woodburn pointed out that the most egalitarian people on Earth, actually existing hunter-gatherers at the time when he was studying in like the 60s, the most egalitarian people on Earth were all immediate return hunter-gatherers, meaning that their subsistence economy did not involve doing work today to get a payoff like later down the road in whatever way, whether that was like harvesting something, food to like store to eat, you know, during the winter, or however that would work. Agriculture is also a delayed return thing, right? Because you plant the seed and then 3 months later you harvest the thing, right? So it's a delayed return. So he pointed out that immediate return hunter-gatherers specifically were the most egalitarian people on Earth. So they bring up Woodburn, and it's nice to see them engaging with someone who studies hunter-gatherers. And they actually portray, you know, his observations positively in the sense that this is not the Rousseauian narrative. These are people who have some awareness about the choices that they make and what kind of political consequences those choices would have.
Right, because importantly, in this part, they talk about how people seem conscious that living off of agriculture is more work and talk about, like, why would we do that? You know, so just as we saw in Clastro's work, people were organizing to keep the state from emerging. And in Bohm's work, people were working to keep from power from being accumulated.
Yeah, I think they even say there's echoes of Christopher Bohm in here.
Then in this case, what Woodburn is documenting is how people are not choosing agriculture intentionally with an eye towards how much work it is.
Or delayed return foraging either.
Right.
You know, yeah, because they understand that an immediate return economy is part of what keeps them free. And so they bring this up as an example quickly to turn it around. And kind of say, this is just another example of everything that's wrong. Because this focus on how people acquire food and whether there's a surplus or not just sets the bar for paradise higher than before. Because now it's not only just like that hunter-gatherers live in the Garden of Eden, but that you need to have this immediate return hunter-gatherer economy in order to be free.
Right. I mean, I know there are problems with this criticism over the years, but I have to acknowledge being somewhat sympathetic with that, in that, you know, if we're already thinking about what is possible and what kinds of social organization we can live within and be free, and we're already limiting it to, or assuming because of what we've learned from trickle-down anthropology, that
I like that.
That we are, we can only be free in hunter-gatherer society or as foragers. And then we learn that actually we can only be free if we also don't store any of that food up.
Right.
Because if we do, then there's going to be abuse of that storage.
Yeah.
Abuse of that surplus. And I mean, that is more constrictive. Absolutely, if you take it at face value that way.
And if you take it as a rule of the universe, a rule of nature or something.
Right.
And I think that's where there's space to disagree with their interpretation.
Right.
Because, like, they are drawing the catastrophic conclusion from this observation of Woodburn's.
Right.
They're like, well, fuck it then. What are we supposed to do?
Right.
Just like go back to all immediate return economies, and that's the only way that we can be free. And I'm not sure that's what Woodburn was saying. You know, I haven't read Woodburn, but if you go to his stuff, does he say at the end, like, and therefore this is what we must now accomplish? Or is that just the first thing that comes to mind? like the way that you expressed it. Yeah, I mean, I get that. That's the first thing that comes to mind. Like, you're like, wait, so how are we going to do that or something?
Right.
But I think what I just want to hold space for with, like, you know, not the first thing that comes to mind, but like pause and be like, well, what I like to remember, partially just for my own sanity, is to account for the patterns that have emerged out of, like, already actually existing human cultures that have been studied, the patterns of how humans have been in the past, of how hunter-gatherers live now in places where they've been studied, is not to map out all of the possibilities. It's just to say that this is how things have happened in the past.
Right.
And the conditions that constituted people's freedoms in the past, or in the Kalahari Desert, or in the Congo Basin, are likely not to be the conditions that constitute our freedoms in the future where we're free again. And sure, some elements of those patterns are going to hold, you know, like in episode 3, we talked about scarcity versus abundance, and just like how abundance sets the stage for freedom a lot better than scarcity does. So what I'm saying now is not to say that there's nothing to learn by looking at these examples. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't be here talking about this book if I thought that there was nothing to learn. But I also think that these patterns that we have seen have emerged from what we have to admit is a narrow slice of the possible.
Right.
It's the potentials within the possible that have actually emerged. You know, and so we shouldn't take them to be too deterministic.
Or too prescriptive.
Of what our futures could look like under very different material conditions.
Yeah. And also, what this chapter reminds me of at times is that I think there can be, if people memorize a story of decline in freedom, the story of the fall, and do tend to hold up and idealize a pretty narrow range of options that are the ones that have emerged, or that they, the ones that they know that have emerged.
Right.
Is maybe what you're saying.
Yeah.
Partially. There can also be this idea that if we did just have certain forms of subsistence, then there would be either egalitarianism, if that's what people value, or there would be freedom, if that's what people value. And in fact, that might just not be the case. And a lot of this book is going to show us examples of different foraging cultures that have neither.
Right.
You know? And so I do think that the demolition of the idea of both progress and decline are important, you know?
Yeah.
And that's part of what they're partaking of here. But I agree with you that just because these examples exist in the past and present doesn't mean that it's prescriptive of the future.
Right.
And if we don't think of it as prescriptive, we don't actually have to destroy it. We can still study it.
Yeah. These examples, they don't determine the future, but they illustrate the kinds of problems that we'll need to solve.
Right, 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 right.
And I think that seeing it that way is, like, you could say that that's maybe the middle road that the Davids don't take.
Right.
You know, they kind of want to just turn our attention away from that, actually, because they can only see it as deterministic.
Right.
Where I think maybe a more reasonable place to land that is to admit that they don't determine the future, but that they help us understand the problems that we'll have to solve.
Right.
Because the kinds of problems and the potential solutions to those problems are patterns that have existed in the past and will repeat themselves into the future.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So after presenting Woodburn and his theories about immediate versus delayed return economies, they come back to their old friend Candy Aronk and state that, you know, all of this about immediate return economies and avoidance of surplus being necessary to preserve freedom mm-hmm. would have come as a big surprise to Candy Aronk, mm-hmm. who, as the character of Adario in Lahontan's book, mm-hmm. expressed surprise at the fact that differences in wealth could translate into mm-hmm. differences in power right. in European society. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're like, so Candy Aronk actually doesn't think that these two things are necessarily linked. Mm-hmm. Candy Aronk thinks that you could have, and presumably in Candy Aronk's Wendat society is what's implied, you could have people with different amounts of wealth. I remember a quote from Candy Aronk where he says something about even wealthy people don't have the power to command others or mm-hmm. something. I can't remember exactly the quote. But they're bringing Candy Aronk in again, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of question this link, you know, that we perhaps take for granted, mm-hmm. like in the culture that we live in and right. just from observing the life around us that like it's that like rich people have more power.
Right.
Have more political power.
Right. It's true that they've given different examples, and we know of examples in which different cultures, some people accumulate wealth, but they're forced to redistribute it. There can be, like, different ways that wealth is accrued, but it doesn't mean you keep it or have power from it.
Yeah.
And so mm-hmm. there are a lot of examples of that. So it is worth noting, though we see lots of examples of how wealth is translated into power where we are, mm-hmm. that is not necessarily a one-to-one equation always.
Yeah, that's right. And I do think that, like in so many things, the devil is in the details, mm-hmm, right? So right. like, what kind of wealth are we talking about?
Right.
You know, if wealth is land, mm-hmm. then it's very easy to see how that could translate into power.
Right.
But if wealth is
trinkets you got from gambling that you can't use to do anything
pretty
to gamble,
rocks that you collected, yeah. you know, that aren't used as a currency in your culture right. or something, and you just have the most pretty mm-hmm. rocks that you collect in the stream bed, and the people like pretty rocks, like you're just like your fellows that you all like pretty rocks, and you have a bigger pretty rock collection or something, it would be easier to imagine that not being able to be translated mm-hmm. into power.
Right.
You know, unless there was some context in which you could exchange the pretty rocks for something, mm-hmm. you know. In capitalist cultures, money is power. Like, you can buy people's labor with mm-hmm. it. You can influence politics with it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all kinds of ways to translate that wealth into power. So it's not so much that wealth always has to equal power, but it's a culturally specific thing where in some cases, and in a lot of cases, wealth can be used to gain more power. Mm-hmm. But it's all about what kind of wealth you're talking about.
Yeah. And so just in case anyone's like hearing this who has access to a lot of wealth, this is not your chance to bypass the responsibility that comes with that.
That's right.
Because in the culture we live in, wealth does equal power. So
there probably are some bankers who are reading this book and they're like, right, yep, that's right, that's right.
Thanks, Graeber.
Candy Aronk yeah. is on my side.
Yeah.
That's a funny thing to think about. But yeah, you know, so what all of this means to them is just more confirmation that inequality, mm-hmm. and like, you know, in particular in this case, wealth inequality, right? Because mm-hmm. circling this back, they set off on all of this by talking about how in the absence of a better metric, traditionally, inequality has been framed as wealth inequality, you know, and so they're saying, so let's just forget about this inequality mm-hmm. thing. And what they propose instead is that what makes these cultures that we admire admirable is mm-hmm. maybe not that the people in them are equal, mm-hmm. but that they are free. Mm-hmm. They also throw in the term autonomy as another possible term. Right. So freedom, autonomy, maybe these might be preferable to equality.
Oh, right. Because they quoted or discussed the work of the feminist anthropologist Eleanor Leacock. And she talked about in the cultures she studied that the women weren't really concerned about being equal at all, but they were concerned about being able to do whatever they felt like doing.
Yeah, to make decisions without the interference of men.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's autonomy.
And that's yeah. autonomy. Yeah. Although, you know, we can see how those are intermeshed mm-hmm. and tied to each other mm-hmm. in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
You know, they're just trying to say, like, it might be better for what we're trying to do, mm-hmm. and better for thinking with,
right,
for this radical imaginary project.
Yeah.
If we just get away from that idea of egalitarianism.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been critical sometimes of their attacks on the egalitarian framing, especially when it refers to anthropological conceptions of, mm-hmm. of different cultures. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I really have no objection to shifting our framework to freedom or autonomy.
Right.
I'm really into those framings as well.
Yeah, and I think that part of what can be frustrating about the focus on this specific situation is that it can feel kind of semantic, because there are definitely plenty of discussions of egalitarianism that we've discussed here, that we've gone over here, that mm-hmm. have felt like we were actually talking about freedom or autonomy.
Yeah,
you know, like, if what people say by what they mean by egalitarianism is freedom from domination,
right,
then there's not a lot of difference.
Yeah, or if your relative equality is based partially on the freedom to leave,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, the freedom to leave is actually one of the freedoms that they enumerate as, like, a foundational freedom. So these are really tangled up in each other.
But we can use
is what you're saying.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I just think it's less clear-cut.
Uh-huh.
And, but I'm down to use their priorities and framing as we move through the rest of the book.
Yeah, and I think it is, like, it is in a way freeing.
Yeah. That's true.
To think about what provides for freedom.
Mm-hmm. And what is also true is, you know, even in Boehm's work, you know, if you actually are trying to study and prioritize a high level of egalitarianism, then you have to leave out a ton of cultures, because so many of them have male dominance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so he had to actually focus on egalitarian cultures between men, mostly.
Right.
You know, and so...
Yeah, if he didn't just want to be studying a very small number of groups.
And so it is... I'm not saying, so, like, let's not worry about gender...
Right.
...relations not being hierarchical, because that's not what I mean. And I still think we need to absolutely pay attention to the patterns of organization for society that lead to that emergence.
Yeah.
But I will say that it is true that it is really limiting if we are only going to look at people who don't have any form of inequality, basically.
Well, yeah. I mean, and, you know, not to get into all of that again, but, you know, egalitarianism is a spectrum.
Right.
And so it's not only the most egalitarian people who interest us, although they are interesting.
Right.
You know, but it's, yeah, it's like egalitarianism as an ethos. But anyway, let's set it aside.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fine to do that now.
Yeah.
You know,
I still want to pay attention to which cultures have freedom and autonomy for women or other kinds of people who aren't men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is going to be important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be to you, of course.
Sure, yeah.
So even if we use freedom and autonomy as lenses, we still need to pay attention to whether or not everyone has that, or mm-hmm. certain classes of people have it and some don't.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. You know, and, like, really, we don't have to say goodbye to it for long, because in just a few chapters, they'll bring egalitarianism back in to propose the existence of egalitarian cities.
Right. That's true.
You know? So they don't want to be done with it for good.
Right.
It's just for now. Kind of right away after changing course away from equality and, like, into the ocean of freedom,
mm-hmm.
they bring up a kind of interesting problem with freedom, like, almost immediately, with freedom as a concept.
Mm-hmm.
And that relates to the fact that people living in a country like the United States, where we live, largely believe that they are free.
Right. Right. Yes. Especially white people.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it's a free country. And that this is the land of the free and all of these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they bring up a really insightful thing to contrast the idea of freedom
mm-hmm.
that, you know, Joe average American, like, might have, versus the freedom that was valued by people like Candy Aronk and the Wendats,
mm-hmm.
or even prehistoric people.
Yeah, this part is super interesting. They talk about the freedoms of folks like Candy Aronk and other similar accounts that we have from that time period,
mm-hmm.
and what they project onto prehistory somewhat as well.
Yeah.
But that people had chiefs in different cultures around the world, but they were chiefs with not a lot of power. They could laugh at them. They could, like, just make fun of them if they tried to coerce the people into doing something. Mm-hmm. You know, that it was sort of like play chiefs, as they would say.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but they had actual freedom of movement, could move around. The ethos of mutual aid in a lot of cultures meant that people were expected to put you up and feed you if you were traveling, mm-hmm. especially in various cultures around Turtle Island, but that was also true in Australia mm-hmm. And other places where there were still a lot of movement of people around. And what they talk about with this is that even though folks say, like, the average American citizen thinks they live in the land of the free, we don't really have much freedom of movement because we can only really travel if we have money to do so. We can only really go places if we have mm-hmm. the means to do so, unless we are going to hitchhike or hop trains or something, you know?
Right.
So what they say, which I think makes sense and is kind of funny, is that the people in these other societies, like Candy Yeronk, had play chiefs but real freedom.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And while we have real chiefs and play freedom.
Yeah, right.
You know, like we
play freedoms.
Play freedoms. Like yeah. These like formal freedoms that are like technically in the Constitution.
Right.
But actually in everyday life, like we're not very free because we all have to work a certain amount or
yeah, exactly.
have requirements of us.
Yeah, they draw the distinction between what they call formal freedoms and mm-hmm. substantive freedoms, where we are formally free to travel from coast to coast across this country, let's say, this continent. But there is nothing done in the culture to actually assure your ability to take advantage of that freedom. Mm-hmm. And they contrast that with these other free cultures where the ethos is not expressed as like, you have the right to travel. You have freedom of movement, but mm-hmm. the ethos is you are expected to take in and provide hospitality to all travelers.
Right.
You know, and that's the ethos, not some abstract freedom of movement, mm-hmm. but something that would actually materially make it possible for you to travel. And I just think that that's like a really brilliant mm-hmm. juxtaposition.
Yeah.
Because like how many people really think that this is the land of the free and that mm-hmm. we have all these freedoms, you know, without really thinking the deeper thought, which is how free are you really, or of what good are those freedoms if you have very little hope of enjoying them, or mm-hmm. if the ability to enjoy them is not equally distributed.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I just think that that's really smart.
It's so interesting.
Yeah. Skipping ahead just a little bit, the David's sketch at the bottom of page 132, three basic, what they're calling freedoms that have come up in the book already, mm-hmm. that they're establishing to potentially be like foundational and important freedoms that kept most of humanity free before we got stuck, as they put it. And they say the freedom to abandon one's community, knowing one will be welcome in faraway lands. Mm-hmm. That's number one. The freedom to shift back and forth between social structures, depending on the time of year. And the freedom to disobey authorities without consequence. They say all appear to have been simply assumed among our distant ancestors, even if most people find them barely conceivable today. So this is like an early sketch. Mm. Coming up in the next chapter or soon after, they will develop these three freedoms.
Mm-hmm. In more detail.
Yeah, more formally mm-hmm. into like basically a theory
right.
of free people and what it takes to make you free or keep you free.
Mm-hmm.
And coming back around, this is at the end of that same paragraph, but coming back around to their developing thesis about mm-hmm. all of the institutions of domination having roots that go all the way back in mm-hmm. human history, they say that we can now ask a revised form of their initial question. The real puzzle is not when chiefs or even kings and queens first appeared, but rather when it was no longer possible simply to laugh them out of court. And this is something that I think is really important to David Graeber.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a theme that has come up in like almost all of his books. It's this idea that this is a key ability that we should be trying to restore.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily to get rid of the office mm-hmm. of the king or the office of the president, like even, but to get rid of the power that that office holds,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to be able to just disobey and to, like, as he says in here, to laugh them out of court.
You mean like the Queen of England?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, some of his favorite ethnographic examples are like people who they live in such and such a country and so-and-so is their king. But whenever the functionaries of that king actually come around to your village, everyone just has to like act like they're doing everything right for a day. And then those people leave and they go back to doing whatever they want. Mm-hmm. You know, like Graeber has always seen a lot of potential mm-hmm. in these types of examples mm-hmm. where like maybe the goal doesn't need to be to actually like storm the castle, take over the government, or depose it or something in some way, but to achieve a situation where the government that exists, mm-hmm. like restore it to the form of just a play government, mm-hmm. to maybe like destitute the power mm-hmm. of the sovereign.
Right.
And so the sovereign can still like think that they're in charge, but they're not actually in charge and everybody knows it. You know, that this is maybe a way that our freedom in the future could go.
So it would have to not be like the Queen of England.
I guess.
There's still this other problem.
So what are the implications of this for the Queen of England? Yeah, so after this section, the Davids are on their way to talking about the work of another prominent hunter-gatherer anthropologist, Marshall Sollins. And the way they get to Sollins is by kind of puzzling over what the connections could be between like work and subsistence and like authority mm-hmm. or what like work and subsistence have to do with freedom. And everything, because, you know, as we just talked about, they question this focus on material surplus, modes of production, mm-hmm. you know, what people did to acquire food or whatever. But they do admit that in work life, mm-hmm. writ large, we can maybe find clues mm-hmm. about how people have become less free.
Yeah.
Is kind of what they're saying in here. And they point out something that I think is really true and really kind of interesting about how we talked a minute ago about how like stereotypical Americans think that they're like the freest people on earth. Mm-hmm. However, people's work environments are almost always hierarchical mm-hmm. and the boss gets to tell you what to do at right. the cost of you like losing your job.
Right.
You know, and so these people who are so proud of being free really overlook the context in which they spend a lot of their waking hours, mm-hmm. like often, you know? I mean, you're either giving the orders or you're taking them or mm-hmm. both, right? Because there's all these, you know, like middle managers and stuff too. And that contradiction is something that is like kind of interesting in politics, where people, when they hear the word politics, they think about power relations mm-hmm. in like government.
Right.
But work is not included in that, where mm-hmm. work relations are obviously political.
Right.
The Davids agree that work and people's work lives or subsistence lives before there were jobs would be like an obvious place to look for maybe where we lost some freedom along the way. Mm-hmm. And here they turn specifically to talking about the contradiction mm-hmm. that exists in technologically advanced capitalist countries where technological advancements that are supposed to be labor-saving have not actually reduced people's work hours.
Right. And in some cases have really increased them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's this part's so interesting because I think I've so internalized the original affluent society idea, which is that hunter-gatherer folks on the whole might have tend to have more free time, which we're going to go into in
that's
a bit.
That's the Sollins piece.
That's the
yeah.
Sollins piece. Mm-hmm. But I think that for a lot of us, who are familiar with the anthropology around that, or at least the trickle-down anthropology around
right,
that.
Right, right.
I forget how even in times when there was a great surge in the amount of work that people were having to do, they were still being fed lines around work reduction, you know? And they talk mm-hmm. about the Victorian era as being one in which people worked obscene hours in the mills, mm-hmm. like 15-hour days, no days off, children working,
right?
You know, all of that for the Industrial Revolution, post the Industrial Revolution, and that all the while, a lot of the theorists of the economy and of that transition were talking about how much work was going to be saved and how much people would have to work less.
Yeah.
Because of these technological advances, when actually the opposite was true.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. It turns out to have no correlation.
Right.
The amount of hours that a worker is expected to work is just based on the amount of exploitation that the bosses can get away with.
Absolutely.
Period.
Yes.
And the increased productivity that comes along with the machines is just used to make the work more profitable for the bosses.
For the bosses, yes. It has zero effect on the workers.
It's not to reduce the workers' hours at all. Yeah.
Right. Every...
In the context of capitalism is what we're talking about here.
Right.
I mean, yeah, like if I buy a washing machine, then I might save work hours washing clothes by having a washing machine. So
that's true.
But that's out of the context of what they're talking about here, like which is the economy.
Except that one could argue that those domestic technologies allowed women to enter the workforce.
Well, yeah, right. So now you're talking about the economy again, like the big picture. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like an individual technology out of context might save labor for a person.
Right.
But that's not how it works in the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as a reminder, you know, the 8-hour workday, weekends, what were once relatively strong child labor laws, which now are being dismantled in different parts of the country,
yeah,
in the United States. All of those were bloody battles that were fought over long periods of time and at great expense to the labor organizers and workers.
Yeah.
And so just a reminder that those were hard-fought battles. The norm was constant work.
Right. Yeah. And it's like really like mind-blowingly just, I don't know, offensive? What's the word? Tone deaf or something? That like Victorian elites were pushing this idea of technological advancement saving labor at a time when the amount of labor exploitation was maybe at its peak.
Absolutely. Yes.
I mean, arguably, at least in like Western Europe and the advanced industrial countries, it maybe went down somewhat after that because of the workers' movement.
Yes.
You know, and the fight for like the 8-hour workday and stuff. And so now that hyper-exploited workforces are all in different countries now, or mostly in different countries.
Right,
I mean, there are prisoners and stuff that have to work really hard. But
It's true that the workdays in some of the, say, like Apple factories in China are close to this.
Yeah.
That's true. That's a good point.
Yeah. But anyway, just like the fact that they tried to maintain this ideology of technical advances, meaning less work at the same time that they were demanding child labor and no weekends and no days off and stuff is just, whoa.
Yeah, actually, when I think about how much people work these days, I'm not even sure if the gains have been kept in reduction of work life. You know, and this is still tied to technology, you know, because as we talked about in season two, the way that people's work lives is tied in with their phones now takes up so much time, you know, and because the cost of living, we're in this housing crisis across the country, the cost of living is so high that a lot of people work two or three jobs, many of them gig jobs, where they're tied to their phone, sending them to do DoorDash or sending them to drive Uber, you know, and
like squeezing in work between work.
Yeah, work between work is happening all of the time.
Yeah.
The amount that like single parents are sleeping is so wild to look at the numbers around that right now.
Like low.
Very low. low capacity for sleep and nourishment.
And then I
think about, you know, speaking of entrepreneurs again, they're like people who are monetizing every hobby.
Yeah.
To also try to make ends meet.
That's huge. I noticed that a lot.
Yeah. And so like a lot of people, especially if they're in debt, don't feel like they can even pursue an interest unless they monetize it right now.
Right.
And so if you think about the time spent on social media creating, quote, content about your hobby or the thing that you're selling, about your art, everybody who is creating on these platforms to supplement their subsistence, it is work. And if we added all those hours together, where are we at? You know, what weekend? You know, what nighttime?
Right.
So I don't know. I was just also thinking about that because here's this like technology for free that's freeing us up and we could be doing other things with.
Yeah.
You know, and how much of our time is now spent working within that technological framework.
Yeah, blurring the lines between what's work and non-work is like part of what capitalism has accomplished.
Absolutely.
So in this context, this idea that technological advances are supposed to be labor-saving, but then the reality of just like increasing work demands and no end to work in sight. Marshall Solins publishes an essay in the 60s called The Original Affluent Society. And the Davids suggest that this might be the most influential anthropological essay ever written, which, I mean, I had definitely heard of this essay before, but I was like, oh, that's cool. That's a bold claim. But definitely, this is like kind of earth-shattering claim that Solins makes. And this is made possible partially because of the increased attention and good data that have been collected from people visiting and studying actually existing nomadic egalitarian hunter-gatherers in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And then these people like came together at a famous conference of hunter-gatherer anthropologists in the 60s, and Solins' work kind of comes out of this. And what Solins showed is that even hunter-gatherers, and there were a couple groups that he specifically studied, like those living in the Kalahari Desert. I think he also studied the Hadza as well. Even the hunter-gatherers that were living in the 20th century in kind of marginal environments where they had to live because agriculturalists and states had kind of taken up all of the really prime land. But even these hunter-gatherers spent a surprisingly little amount of time actually assuring their subsistence. You know, their work hours spent in collecting food, processing food, maintaining their tools, whatever it took to ensure their subsistence, was way, way less than even the 40-hour work week that the labor unions had fought so hard to secure earlier in the 20th century. And that these people spent a lot of their time actually just, you know, enjoying each other's company, traveling for pleasure, making music, telling stories, cutting up and making each other laugh, you know, all kinds of things, but not so much hard labor. And some folks maybe only had to like work a couple days a week in order to ensure their subsistence. In fact, Solins said that perhaps our hunter-gatherer ancestors lived in the original affluent society, you know, and this was like a paradigm shifting thing, as you might imagine, you know, because the industrial West and everything is likes to think of itself as affluent. But Solins was basically saying, well, these people have everything that they need. They feel like they lack nothing materially, and they have lots of time, which is maybe more than even like a wealthy industrialist has, you know, in the capitalist West.
All the time that money can't buy.
That's right. Yeah.
That's so interesting because it makes me think about how, you know, in the Victorian era, which we were just talking about, those folks were seeing the hard scrabble lives. The wealthy theorist is who I'm speaking of.
Yeah.
We're seeing the hard scrabble lives and intense workload of the poor around them, of the proletariats. And before that, you know, in the feudal times, people were, the people with money and land, the landed gentry, were seeing the relatively hard work lives of the peasants who worked their land. And then taking those images, which are actually the creation of scarcity and systems of domination, and then projecting them onto the past and saying, well, all people's lives have always been this meager and hard.
Yeah, right.
Until there were wealthy people like us.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It's almost like, I mean, this is not what you're saying, but it's almost like they watched too many Trials of Life type of nature shows.
Right.
Where, like, every animal is just on the brink of starvation.
Well, yeah. I mean, and you have people like Hobbes saying, this is what people lived like.
That's what people lived like. Right. And yeah, as we alluded to already, Solins' observation, the evidence actually bears this out. For the most part, nomadic hunter-gatherers have low work hours compared to the agriculturalists who would succeed them. And as bad as feudalism was in so many ways, medieval serfs worked less than the factory workers in the capitalist system that would come after it. So you can imagine how these observations stemming from Solins would like ripple out and really change people's conception.
Right.
the David's claim that we probably would never have had movements like primitivism or degrowth without this essay, mm-hmm. or without something that revealed
the same.
The things that this essay yeah. reveals. And maybe we could even add to that, like things like the paleo movement.
Yeah, that's true.
The paleo diet or something. Right. And just like the anti-work movement mm-hmm. as well. I mean, you know, I grew up in like the 80s and 90s at a time when, especially in anarchist circles, like anti-work right. and the revolt against work had a big presence, mm-hmm. you know, and part of that was a reaction to like the workerist movements that were like the right. Marxist movements, but also they came out partially of this type of anthropology. Mm-hmm. They were informed by that. Mm-hmm. Like, why do we need to work this much? Or maybe work at all, you know?
I mean, Engraver's firmly in that tradition, or at least
oh yeah,
as well, you know, I mean, he has oh, yeah. a whole book about.
And Marshall Solins was his advisor.
Oh, right. And yeah, I wanted to add that too, is because they are going to criticize this work in a little bit.
Yeah.
But just to be clear, like Solins and Graeber are not only was Solins Graeber's advisor, but they wrote a book together.
They
collaborate. Mm-hmm. They're pals.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, so
yeah.
While they have some issues with this, they are a bit kinder than they are with some of their colleagues.
Yeah, right. The Davids present this essay. They affirm the truth of the broad strokes of what's being pointed out here, mm-hmm. that work hours have actually kind of increased as people move into agriculture and capitalism and so forth. But they have two really big objections to the Solins article.
Right.
One of them is more theoretical, mm-hmm. and the other is like maybe more material. The first objection is that they think that Solins is basically giving us a Garden of Eden story all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Solins is presenting us with a morality tale
mm-hmm.
about people who had a good thing
mm-hmm.
and then they fucked up by entering into agriculture, would be right. like the short version of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not sure if that's the way that Solins specifically presents that. But they still think that this is basically what people take away mm-hmm. from the Solins
yes.
story anyway. Is that like, and then we had to like fuck up and do agriculture,
right?
You know, and that sent us down, you know, and then we did industrialization and like each technological advance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this is the right framing really, but the way that they're talking about this is that according to Solins, each technological advance actually just gets us deeper into the trap. Specifically like the work trap,
right.
but also it kind of goes together with loss of freedoms in other ways as well.
Right.
And my big objection to the way this is being framed, and again, I don't know if the Davids are framing it this way exactly, or if it's Solins or both,
mm-hmm.
but to portray this as like, and then we made a bad choice.
Right.
Right. Like we, for one thing, I hate the we. Like when you're talking about the broad strokes of history
or the present
and all of the bad places that things have gone,
right?
You know, including up to and including the present,
mm-hmm.
you know, so many people do this where they talk in a way that assumes like there's a collective will that's being expressed,
right?
You know, like they'll be like, when will we wake up to the reality of climate change and decide to do something different and
right.
to fix what we've broken or whatever. And I'm like, who's your we?
Right.
You know, that we glosses over so many mm-hmm. like very important political realities that are happening. And I assume that like, you know, 10,000 years ago, getting into agriculture was the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it wasn't humanity made this mistake.
Right.
And now we're paying for it, just in the same way that humanity's paying for Eve's mistake in the Garden of Eden.
Right.
Yeah, that is just, I mean, whatever. This episode could get way longer at this point, talking about like what actually probably did happen. But in some ways, the Davids actually encourage this way of thinking because they lean so heavily on choice.
Oh, absolutely.
And they think that social formations and social structures and political structures are a result of people's choices, or at least that they did maybe up until a certain point mm-hmm. or something. But in prehistory, it was a matter of choice
mm-hmm.
when people were still free.
Right. I mean, that's really getting to the heart of one of the major issues for me with the book, is that I, too, am very critical of the fall, which I've probably said 10 times at this point through the season. But if you are going to frame everything as choice without other factors, or the choice is absolute, then you're absolutely feeding into an Edenic narrative.
Right.
Because you're not talking about other pressures, other conditions. It's all about, did you choose it or not? Are you going to eat the apple or not?
Yeah, right. And we can and maybe should say that also in reverse, just to hammer it home. If you are really against Garden of Eden fall type of narratives, then don't frame political formations as solely a matter of choice.
Right.
Because that is the Garden of Eden narrative, is that Eve or Adam, you know, chose to eat of the tree of knowledge. And they're paying for that choice. But when we recognize that people get potentially like pushed towards some of these options, intensification strategies, delayed return economies, agricultural-based economies, because of like conditions that push them in that direction or make them maybe even necessary for survival, then that realization alone makes this not a fall narrative, not a Garden of Eden narrative, at least not in that way that we are guilty of having done it.
I think also this ties back into, as we move forward, say we are crafting societies within the crumble of empire, just to keep in mind that we will have some capacity for discussion and creation, but at the same time, there will be pressures and external factors that have to be considered as well.
Right.
You know, and that, again, as we've already said in this episode, just paying attention to what those patterns are and what those pressures can do.
Right.
That might go against your best intentions.
Right.
For autonomy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay, we are going to leave it right there for this episode. We'll come back next time to finish up the conversation. We'll be talking about the Poverty Point Earthworks in so-called Louisiana, some very affluent foragers, and how wild tending and horticulture can be conducive to freedom. It's a great wrap-up. Join us next time. Until then, bye y'all.